good afternoon, Juno. It's just a few seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. It's time for Juneau Afternoon. My guests today will include Julie Hamilton, who's the winner of the 2014 Harold T. Cavan Professorship out at UAS. She'll be here to tell us about that new professorship. Tonight's fireside lecture, Glaciers Impact Southeast Bears. So our guest will come in to tell us about the presentation that will be at the Glacier Visitor Center tonight at 6:30 and 8 o'clock. The Alaska Garden Club President, Molly Hodges, will come in to tell us about a garden conference coming up. And Pat McClear and Jim Kiefer will be here to tell us about John Coltrane's musical Spiritual Journey. This will be a special service of the Juneau Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. And we'll hear a little bit about Christina Apathy's opening coming up on Saturday out at Paradise Cafe. Right now it's time for National Native News. Stay tuned for Juneau Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Canada, British Columbia First Nations cautiously approach the development of liquefied natural gas. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, they gathered to discuss the issue.
The Premier, Christy Clark, won last year's provincial election in part on a promise to encourage and foster a $1 trillion liquefied natural gas industry in British Columbia. She said it could create 100,000 jobs and wipe out the provincial debt, and that could all begin to happen by 2017. Last week, a First Nations summit on the industry took place in Fort St. John in northeastern B.C. The chief of the West Moberly First Nation, Roland Wilson, says there are already thousands of natural gas fracking wells in the territory. Wilson says if Clark's plans for the industry go full steam ahead, it would mean many more, up to 80,000 more.
The majority of people in British Columbia, when they talk about LNG, they think about the ships that are going overseas, but they don't understand that in order to put the LNG in those ships, they got to poke holes in the ground in northeastern BC and fill the pipeline up to get it through.
The First Nations Summit was intended to bring greater awareness to the industry's development and how it could affect social, environmental, and other issues. In addition, critics say LNG terminals and related pipelines are high-risk facilities, and environmental activists say LNG has a carbon impact 30% greater than domestic natural gas. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Filmmakers in Rapid City, South Dakota, are creating a documentary about Lakota star knowledge for the Journey Museum. The names children learn for constellations are from Greek and Roman traditions, but other cultures like the Lakota define them in their own terms. Victoria Wicks reports.
On a Saturday afternoon at the Journey Museum, about a dozen students from Spring Creek Elementary School on the Rosebud Reservation gather to make a documentary. The children play supporting roles. The star of the movie is Dr. Craig Howe from the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies, located near Martin between the Rosebud and Pine Ridge Reservations. He's here to tell the children about Lakota star knowledge.
Through this tradition and all of their traditions, Lakotas situated themselves as relatives to all the entities in the world, the stars and the other entities in the celestial sphere, and then all these entities on the terrestrial sphere and even below. So it was one large integrated universe from a Lakota viewpoint.
Inside a portable planetarium, Howe tells stories while images of the sun, the moon, and constellations move across the night sky projected on the domed ceiling and walls. Film director Sam Hurst says Lakota people observed astronomical phenomena that were witnessed elsewhere in the world. In one segment of the documentary, the Spring Creek students view the museum's winter counts kept by the elders in small Lakota bands. Hurst says all 70 known winter counts for 1833 included a November meteor shower.
And then if you look up the art and the recordings of Western civilization about that night, and Chinese civilization about that night, it turns out it was a universal experience.
The filmmakers say that learning how ancestors viewed the cosmos does not run contrary to today's science. Craig Howe explains.
It wasn't important for them to know how to land a spacecraft on the moon or send one to Mars. And that requires scientific expertise and precision. And the Lakota way is to make sense of the world.
Howe says passing along Lakota star knowledge does not scientifically explain the universe, but it lets children know how their Lakota ancestors believed the universe was structured. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Today we remember Kwatsan elder and headbird singer Willard Golding. He passed away in February 2013 after an illness. Golding spent his life on the Fort Yuma Reservation in Arizona. Boss Man, as he was often called, taught generations of bird singers and passed on the tradition to Colorado River tribes. Golding was 70 years old at the time of his death. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. National Native News is made possible with support from Guest House Anchorage Inn. Wake up with the sun on the web at guesthousealaska.com.
Join us for Kawanak's 2014 Alaska Native Art Auction, Thursday, February 20th in Anchorage, Alaska. Ticket and reservation information is available by going to nativeartauction.org. Proceeds benefit National Native News.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's just a few seconds after 6 after 3 on KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My first two guests are here to tell us about a very prestigious award, which was won by one of them. Katie Jordan, who is the Community Outreach Coordinator with the School of Management up at the University of Alaska Southeast, has brought Julie Hamilton down to the station. And Julie is an assistant professor at the university teaching accounting out there, and she is the winner of the 2014 Harold T. Cavan Professorship. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I thought it might be interesting for those of our listeners who were not involved in academia to talk a little bit about what professorships mean, because this is an opportunity really to have a little freedom beyond the day-to-day work that you do.
Right, and this was founded in 1974 through Loretta Cavan, and her husband Harold Cavan was a vice president at First National Bank of Anchorage, and so the endowment is really with the foundation, and excuse me. So every 2 years they give this $20,000 professorship to a University of Alaska professor.
So this is all three campuses that would have competed.
Correct.
For the award.
Yes.
And you won.
Yes.
Yeah. So what was the project that you proposed to them?
My project is centered around my income tax class. So I teach individual income taxes in my second semester teaching it. And I'm trying to get my students involved in actually preparing tax returns. And to do that, I've brought in the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program curriculum into my classroom, so all students get certified through this IRS program, so then they're able to work at VITA sites, and even if they're a distant student, I have students in Anchorage and Fairbanks and elsewhere, and they can work at a VITA site elsewhere too.
So now a VITA site is a place where these students would actually assist someone in preparing their tax return?
Right, right. Volunteer income tax assistance sites are done in coordination with the IRS, and the site we have here, we coordinate with Tlingit and Haida Regional Housing Authority. So our students are working at the VITA site every Tuesday night and some Saturdays to prepare taxes. So the professorship goes beyond that, beyond just teaching the VITA curriculum and having the students work on people's taxes. There's an education component, not only in my classroom, but also some professional education that we can travel to, and the AICPA puts on a tax symposium every year that we'll go to and get some high-level training in taxes. We're going to do some traveling VITA sites, so small communities around Southeast will take all of our VITA stuff with us and prepare tax returns there. So VITA sites really focus on low to middle income families and individuals, and we help them. We actually prepare their tax return, they bring in all their stuff, and we file it at the same time. It gets reviewed, they know how much they're getting back, and you know, we just do all the work for them at that time. So
I think there's some limits on what you can bring to a VITA site, if I'm right.
Right,
like you can't,
right.
They won't do business returns or
we can do very small business returns. So if it would show up on like a Schedule C EZ, less than $10,000 in receipts for that small business, and the students, you know, for the students to get the real experience of preparing these tax returns that aren't super complicated, big businesses we wouldn't do, some larger rentals, we wouldn't do, things like that. But the small, you know, regular taxpayer who, when you look at a tax return, sometimes it's a little overwhelming to prepare. And so since the students have taken my class and they're VITA certified, they're just happy to help, and the clients, the tax clients, are so happy to have that assistance too.
So now, Katie, you must have had to do some of the coordination to set this up, being the community outreach person.
Well, Julie's done. She applied for it all on her own, and I am helping her now to market the on-campus, the dates for the on-campus VITA sites that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. So we've been working on that.
This is to help students at the UAS campus.
Exactly, yeah.
Primary.
It's another component of the program that I submitted for the professorship. So we've got students helping students on campus on certain Friday afternoons, and they'll come in and prepare their tax return and file it.
Now, you said our VITA site here in town is with Clinkett and Hyde. If I remember right from previous shows, though, anyone can come in as long as their tax return isn't some kind of complex thing involving estates or
correct,
or you know, all of the big, thick paperwork kind
yes,
of stuff.
Yes, we have people from all over Juneau come in. We've had people come in from outlying communities, too, and get their taxes done by us.
Now, there's some additional, maybe it's not additional, maybe it's the same program. I know that there that senior citizens have access to some tax preparation assistance. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to do with that? Or?
It's the same program,
is
really.
Okay.
And there was one at the Mendenhall Mall for many years, and it hasn't been going this year or last year. So we've received some of those tax clients coming to our site.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the same program. It's got a different name, but a lot of places prepare those tax returns through an AARP-affiliated site.
I want to concentrate on your professorship, but if someone hearing this program wants to take advantage of the assistance that VITA offers, how do they do it? Do you know?
They can come to our site at Clinkett and Hyde Regional okay. Housing Authority, which is on Jenkins Drive, and that's every Tuesday from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. April 15th is our last Tuesday to do that. And then we have Saturday, the three Super Saturdays. One's already done, and we have two more coming up. There's one on March 8th, and I believe the other one is on April 5th.
Okay.
And those are at the Clinkett and Hyde Vocational Tech Center. And those are from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Now, you said the additional funding out of the professorship is going to allow you to take some students out to some of the Southeast Alaska villages with VITA capability. This is something that would not have happened had you not received the professorship. Is that
correct?
Right?
That's correct. And we're working with communities and the IRS to find out where there would be most benefit. So I could take perhaps two or three students to Haines and Skagway, which I believe currently don't have VITA sites, the Tenneke Springs and Gustavus, so we could make a couple of long weekends and go prepare tax returns at those sites and have that paid through the professorship.
Mm-hmm. Which is wonderful.
Yeah, definitely. I think what's so cool about this project is that it really is, it is truly what the School of Management is about, really providing that real-world experience. Julie talks about watching her students who have been in class, learning how to do this, then sitting across from who is now their client, acting professional, you know, answering their questions, making it less intimidating. So it's really awesome to see the accounting curriculum then put into practice and have these students get that real-world experience.
You've been an accountant doing tax stuff for about 25 years.
Right. I focused more on tax work in my early years. So with L.G. Rehfeld, Deloitte & Touche in Seattle, and with Wolf & Hamilton when I had that CPA firm, that was a lot of tax work in those early years. Then later when I went to Juneau Youth Services as a CFO and then to the permanent fund, I did less taxes, but I've always done them at least for a handful of family and friends every year.
I'm curious as to how you discovered that you could apply for this grant or this professorship and what the process was for getting it.
Okay, right. There was an announcement that came out from the foundation, University of Alaska Foundation, just calling for people to submit proposals, and it's very broad in scope. It's basically business and finance professors, teaching in the university system and asking for ways that they could sort of expand upon what they're teaching in the classroom, go beyond their regular faculty assignments. So when that announcement came out and I read what they were asking for, it just dawned on me that it would work well with what I wanted to do for income tax, to really teach my students beyond the textbook.
And so you filed this application, and lo and behold, there it was. Do you get a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning from a person in Sweden?
Really similar, but no. I think it was an email about 4 in the afternoon from the university.
At which point everyone was wondering why you were running up and down the halls yelling whoopee, yeah?
Right.
Okay, well, hey, congratulations. Wonderful thing, and a program that helps us and helps you and brings a new dimension to the University of Alaska Southeast School of Management and an opportunity for accounting students to work in the real world. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you.
From Pie in the Sky, now taking orders for Mardi Gras king cake, bourbon pecan pies, and more, including gluten-free holiday desserts. Pie in the Sky, located on Seward Street or at 523-9135.
This is Bird Note. A flash of glittering dark blue cuts through the gray of late February as a male tree swallow glides low over a cattail marsh. The tree swallow's liquid notes hint at spring's approach, where a broad green pasture meets the forest edge. There is a second, even brighter flash of blue. A male bluebird alights on a fence post. The intense blue of its back glints in the welcome sunlight of late winter. Tree swallows, and all three North American bluebird species, are among the earliest northbound migrants to arrive, heralding spring a month before the equinox. Both species will nest only in cavities, such as old woodpecker holes or man-made nest boxes. The supply of such specialized nest sites is limited. Competition is intense. By arriving so early, tree swallows and bluebirds improve their chances of finding unoccupied cavities, and they may fiercely guard a nest site until April, before actually nesting. Both species benefit greatly from nest box programs, but it's crucial to put up only nest boxes with very specific hole sizes that encourage these flashy blue migrants, but deter non-native starlings and house sparrows. To learn about how to provide just the right home for tree swallows and bluebirds, come to our website, birdnote.org.
It's about 18 minutes and a half after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is going to be delivering the Fireside Lecture out at the Glacier Visitor Center tonight with two shows, one at 6:30 and one at 8 o'clock. And Tanya Lewis is an expert on bears. She's a wildlife biologist with the Glacier National Park and Preserve, and she's going to talk to us about glacier bears and other kinds of bears and like that. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I guess the thing that intrigues me is that you're actually going to talk about glacier bears, and that's a rarity.
It is.
Can you explain how we know we're looking at a glacier bear, if we should ever happen to see one?
Glacier bears are a distinct color phase of black bears, and you basically just can tell by their color. They can be gray, silver, white, even blue. They're described as blue, kind of a deep silver. And we don't know a lot about them. At first I was asked to give a lecture on glacier bears. I said, well, that would take about 10 minutes. So I'm going to deliver those 10 minutes in the context of black and brown bears in Southeast Alaska and the biogeography of the area, which, if you're not familiar with that term, that means how the plants and animals relate to the landscape and the changes over time.
So if we were to see a glacier bear, then would it later change color to become a different color? I mean, is this like seasonal color change?
No, I think they keep their color. Okay. They might look a little bit more glacier at certain times of the year because bears do molt and change their fur, and so it gets bleached out in the early part of the summer, and then they shed out. So it could change subtly and maybe a bit over time, but generally a glacier bear is a glacier bear. Some of them are quite subtle, though, like just some silver, like along the back, mm-hmm. that is hard to detect, and the rest of the fur being black. So there's a real a wide spectrum of the color phase.
And we have a significant number of black bears in the Juneau area.
Yes.
But very few brown bears.
Yes.
Why is that?
I think the main reason is because of the development and the topography. You know, Juneau is up against the mountains, against the ice field, and brown bears need a lot of space, and people don't tolerate them as well as black bears, especially if they're not familiar with them. They're more likely, it seems like, to get shot in defense of life and property or you know, if people feel threatened. And they need a lot of space, too. They might not be as comfortable around people at first. So I would guess they stay on the fringes of Juneau, and there's definitely bears to the north and the south.
We have a huge population of brown bears, as I understand it, out on the islands to the west of us.
Yep, and I'm going to be talking about that, why that is. There's islands in northern southeast with only brown bears, and in southern southeast there are only black bears on islands. So it's very interesting, and you know, we don't know exactly why that is, but there are some hypotheses.
I've also heard something that is quite intriguing. As I understand it, the bears that are out on Admiralty Island are not as closely related to bears on the mainland as they are actually related to bears from the northern part of the United States.
Yeah, so that's a good story, and it is I'm going to try and tease that out tonight, too. There's different ways of looking at genetic relatedness on different timescales, and without going into it too much, basically the bears on Admiralty, Baranof, and Chichagof are in an ancient lineage that has descended from polar bears.
Hmm.
And but there is still mixing. They're not genetically isolated. So there is they are more connected to brown bears in this area on contemporary time scale.
I see.
It's pretty complicated, but
complicated.
I made some little graphics and diagrams, and hopefully it'll...
So can you give us kind of a summary then of what we're going to see tonight and when you
sure.
do your presentation?
Yeah, basically I'm going to give a quick review of the geologic past of the area, last 40, 60,000 years, but mainly starting at the last glacial maximum, about 20,000, and go over the other influences on the landscape, and then talk about how that affects black and brown bear habitat, food resources, and then their distributions, as we just talked about, the islands and where they overlap and where they don't and why. And then the genetics. And there's been some cool recent studies that I'm going to touch on, including my own master's thesis I completed in Glacier Bay looking at population genetics of brown bears in a very recently deglaciated landscape.
And you're with the Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve.
That's
so
correct,
what
yeah.
area is that? Does that encompass?
Oh, it's big. It's you know, basically Excursion Inlet over all the way over to Gulf of Alaska and up to Dry Bay, the mouth of the Elsec River. So it's the Fairweather Mountain Range, or a lot of it, and some of the Chilkats, and a bunch of Outer Coast, and then Glacier Bay proper, and Dundas Bay.
And then do you get out in that area very much?
Yes, I do, as much as possible.
How?
For work and play.
How do you travel?
You know, for work I end up in motorboats more often than I would prefer. My preferred method is either kayaking or rowing or sailing if possible. But all sorts of boats. Boats are the way to get around. And, you know, in the winter it's fun to just see how far you can get up into the mountains on skis as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wish my viewers could see your eyes when you say that. You obviously like your work.
Yeah, I'm ready for a trip, actually.
Yeah. So when you go out, how much other than camping equipment are you carrying? What kind of specialized gear do you have to
for
have
the research?
For your work? Yeah.
You know, my main gear is my GPS. I have a sort of a data logger GPS that I collect all my data in, and binoculars, obviously. I do a lot of bird work, too. I'm in town for the bird conference, the Pacific Seabird Group Conference, and so, you know, definitely good optics are important for watching birds and bears. Notepad, write in the rain, paper, good rain gear.
For sure. Absolutely, for sure. Why is Southeast Alaska, why do we have such a huge population of bears here?
Well, you know, it's largely wild land, hasn't been impacted. I mean, very minorly impacted. That's what I love about it. It's like little islands of humanity surrounded by natural ecosystems and abundant salmon streams and good alpine habitat. And, it, you know, basically all of Alaska, where the, most of Alaska, at least on the coast, where there aren't people, there's lots of bears.
How does our bear population compare to other places in the world? Do we? I'm trying to get at something that you could say to someone from outside to give them an idea of how many more bears there are here than there are where they may live from.
Yeah, that's kind of complex. Just it really depends on the food resources and the habitat. Inland, there are way fewer bears. There's just not the coastal resources. So as far as actual numbers, we don't have any abundance estimates or density estimates for Glacier Bay. And for, I think there's been a lot more work on brown bears than black bears in Southeast Alaska. And so there probably are some estimates for certain areas. You know, Admiralty Bear Nachtchichkov has been studied quite a bit, and pretty high densities similar to the Alaskan Peninsula, which is probably some of the densest, as dense as bears get. And it just means that they have all the food they can eat, and they're at a certain carrying capacity, and they're not being killed by people at a rate that's too high.
And then I guess for a final question, there's there are a lot of tour operators who specialize in getting people out where they can see bears or getting them close. Is there is that interaction, is that a problem for the bears?
Well, that's a great question. So bears are very adaptable. They're super smart animals, and they will learn really quickly that people are not a threat if they interact with people and don't get hurt, which is most bear viewing. They might get a little bit irritated with the person with the big camera getting too close, but they're not getting hurt. So they habituate, and they get used to people. And the only time that generally that habituation is a problem is if people aren't keeping their trash and their birdseed and their pet food secure from bears, because bears get habituated comfortable around people. They're generally actually safer, and it's great for bear viewing, but they might come into people's yards and get in trash, and at that point, they risk becoming food conditioned, and that's very different because at that point, they start looking to people for food, and they usually end up getting killed. It's very sad.
Yeah.
And for some reason, we have not figured out how to keep clean as a species yet.
Glacier Bay National Park wildlife biologist Tanya Lewis is giving two presentations tonight, How Glaciers Impact Southeast's Bears. Both of those will be at the Glacier Visitors Center out at the Glacier. It opens up on Friday nights for these special presentations. The first one is at 6:30, and an exact repeat of the 6:30 presentation will be at 8 o'clock, so either one is the same. Come to either one and get a chance to catch up on the news about Alaska's bears down here. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 21st of February, 2014. It's the birthday of David Foster Wallace, Ithaca, New York, 1962. Author of Infinite Jest, came out in 1996. 1,079 pages, 388 footnotes, a novel about addiction and tennis and separatist groups, among many other things, a bestseller. He was working on a novel at the time of his death, about a third of the way done. It was published in 2011, entitled The Pale King. David Foster Wallace, who said, "Postmodern irony and cynicisms become an end in itself, a measure of hip sophistication and literary savvy. Few artists dare to try to talk about ways of working toward redeeming what's wrong, because they'll look sentimental and naive to all the weary ironists. Irony's gone from liberating to enslaving. The postmodern founders' patricidal work was great, but patricide produces orphans, and writers my age have been literary orphans throughout our formative years." It's the birthday of the poet who said, "I was, and in most respects still am, mentally precocious, physically backward, short-sighted, a rabbit at all games, very untidy and grubby, a nail-biter, a physical coward, dishonest, sentimental, with no community sense whatever." W. H. Auden, born in York, England, 1907. When he was 15, at boarding school, he had a crush on a boy named Robert Medley. They went on a walk in the countryside together. Medley asked Auden if he wrote poetry, and Auden had never written poetry, but he decided to try, and soon after had his first poem published. W. H. Auden, who said, "Among those whom I like or admire, I can find no common denominator, but among those whom I love, I can. All of them make me laugh." First issue of the New Yorker magazine, published on this date in 1925, founded by Harold Ross and his wife Jane Grant, who was a reporter for the New York Times. And it was on this day that the most influential political pamphlet of all time was first published, The Communist Manifesto, written by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, 1848. Most of the ideas brainstormed over the course of a week and a half in a room above an English pub called the Red Lion in the Soho district of London. Karl Marx had the job of drafting up the ideas into something publishable, a call to action aimed at the proletariat across Western Europe. Here's a poem by W. H. Auden on his birthday, Nonsense Song. "My love is like a red, red rose, or concerts for the blind. She's like a mutton chop before and a rifle range behind. Her hair is like a looking glass, her brow is like a bog, her eyes are like a flock of sheep seen through a London fog. Her nose is like an Irish jig, her mouth is like a bus, her chin is like a bowl of soup shared between all of us. Her form divine is like a map of the United States, her foot is like a motor car without its license plates. No steeplejack shall part us now, nor fireman in a frock. True love could sink a channel boat or knit a baby's sock." A Nonsense Song by W. H. Auden, from the collection As I Walked Out One Evening, published by Vintage Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 27 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next two guests are here to tell us about a garden symposium, which is coming up on March 7th and 8th. Joining me here today are Molly Hodges and Brad Flitch, and the two of them are going to be principals in the presentation. On Friday, March 7th, the concentration is on horticultural adventures in business. And on March 8th, it's on the gifts of gardening. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, first of all, this I haven't heard a lot about this prior to now. You're just really getting on the publicity, I guess.
Huh? Oh, we are just starting up, and we're hoping we hit it hard now. Yeah.
So this is March 7th and 8th, about 3 weekends away, and just in time, I think, for people who are now starting to plant seeds in their garages and back rooms and get them germinating so that they're ready to go.
Yes, and those of us that are just kind of dreaming of getting back into the soil.
I know the garden, the community garden had a meeting the other night, and they're getting together, I think, on the 15th to plant the stuff for their annual plant sale. So.
There we go.
I believe I'm going to wind up with several flats of herbs in my side room after that process.
Plant sale is always a big one.
It is. So tell us about the upcoming symposium.
Well, we've got two days, Friday evening, and that, like you said, is going to be with a focus on more the business aspects, which you might go, well, I'm not so interested in that, but we've got an exciting lineup, so you might want to pop into that. That night is free. The next day is all day from 10 to 5:30, and we've got the three speakers from the night before, as well as a couple more. So who are we having down? We're having Pat Holloway from the University of Fairbanks, and she did research on peonies. She's done research on blueberries, and you go, well, peonies are fine for really hardy gardeners, but maybe not me, but I think you'd be surprised, and Brad will talk about that more, too. And peonies are now a major export in Alaska, so we're real excited to hear more about that. Pat also runs the botanical gardens at the UAF, and she's done blueberry research, so her knowledge is broad. And on Saturday, we'll be talking specifically to the home gardener. So please keep that in mind. And Charlotte Jewell's coming down from Skagway. Mm-hmm. She has the Jewell Gardens and glassblowing business up there, and people rave about it. I'm excited to see it. I have yet to see it. She also does organic produce and delivers boxes around Skagway, much like we can get here from down south, but hers is local, so that's exciting. She has greenhouses, and she does starts, and she sells that locally as well. So we've got Charlotte. We've got Merrill Jensen from the Jensen Olson Arboretum here in town, and he, the Arboretum has just recently been awarded the status of having the most primroses in documented number of primroses in North America, the varieties. And he'll be talking about that and other things. We're excited about having him present. Lois Dworshak will be there to talk about invasives, and she's always fun to listen to. And we'll have Brad Fletch, who is our major peony grower here in town.
So, Brad, you're actually making a go of commercial peony production in Juneau, Alaska.
Well, I right now I have, you know, well, they had a sale on them at Walmart right now, and so I bought a bunch more. So, yeah, I have over 100 plants in the ground on the property, but I'm actually looking to permit a actual peony farm here in Juneau. And I've been, I just got done having conversations with the Army Corps. I've already talked to the city planning department and getting all the permits necessary to actually start a farm here. It's a little surprising, but yeah, you actually need permits to farm.
I'm sure you do. You have to have a permit for almost anything. So why peonies? What is it about Alaska and peonies that
Well,
makes that
actually, it's because of Dr. Holloway. I've always liked peonies because they're beautiful flowers, and I just love the way they're so fragrant. And we used to have them as a kid, and Mom would make these beautiful bouquets. And so, anyway, I was just reading the internet, and I had noticed that the Alaska Peony Project, and it caught my attention, so I had read about it. And so I've been in communications with Dr. Holloway since, like, 2003, sending pictures of the peonies in our garden. And there's this old nursery lady here in town, Emily Cherry. And I don't know if many people remember her, but she had that little greenhouse flower shop out in Auk Bay just on the way to the ferry terminal. And she had the most gorgeous peonies right there on the corner of her property. I mean, they were, you know, 5 feet wide, and they had like 40 stems all in full bloom. And it's just like, wow. And so, and then I was reading about it and how the peonies came about and how the Dr. Holloway discovered the market for them. And what's unique about Alaska is that we are the place on Earth peonies are blooming during the North American wedding season. And these are the premier cut flower. And so they're getting somewhere between $4 and $7 a stem. And, you know, a mature peony plant's going to kick out at least 10, you know, commercial quality stems a year. And so when you do the math, and I'm a financial analyst, and, you know, it's like, well, this is the most profitable legal crop you can grow in Alaska. So, it's staggering, the value per acre. And here about 7 or 8 years ago, there was a peony conference held here in Centennial Hall, and I had the opportunity to videotape Rita Jo Schultz, who is a big peony grower on the Kenai Peninsula, and she has a large nursery. And the whole story that she gave, it's an hour-long video on the Internet, and it's how a couple, a husband and wife, on a third of an acre could generate about $75,000 of revenue a year. And, you know, peonies are just the perfect plant for us Alaskans. There are no natural enemies up here. There are no pests. Deer won't eat them. Nothing likes them. They don't want to eat a lot. They don't want a lot of attention. All you have to do is plant them at the right depth. If you can do that, you can grow peonies. And so, I mean, it's just the perfect Alaskan retirement plant.
Well, what a delight. And you're going to be talking about this? Are you going to show any excerpts of this video?
No. I mean, you can just go to Vimeo.com and Google it, you know, and how to grow or Alaska peonies and or Rita Jo Schultz, and you'll find it. But, you know, more or less, I think that's what Dr. Holloway and I'm going to talk about on Friday night, the business venture of it. The amount of acres being planted in peonies right now is massive. I mean, we're talking, you know, there's probably 500-700 acres that are currently planted into peonies.
In Alaska.
Huh. And so one of the interesting things is you know, right now is how we actually help each other. Fairbanks is a little bit different than us. Kenai is a little bit different than us. And so Southeast adds sort of this unique diversifying effect. Because a lot of the growers work through the Alaska Peony Growers Association for the marketing and the business aspects of sales. Mm-hmm. And so by being able to produce them slightly earlier, slightly later, we expand our market. Weather hits them, weather hits us. It helps sort of all the Alaskan growers to incorporate Southeast. So I think we'll be probably the first peony farm in Southeast.
Well, what an interesting development that I had not heard of at all. And that's really exciting because agricultural activity in Southeast Alaska has been kind of at a standstill since we were feeding ourselves back during the 1890s. So, and I understand you're going to be talking about some of the archived stuff that you're working on with the university. Is that part of this?
I don't think so.
Oh, you're not going to bring that up. Okay. Okay. Pat Holloway and Brad Flitch are going to talk about the peony thing. Meryl Jensen is going to be talking about the Jensen Olson Arboretum. And their primrose collection. They're the National Primrose Repository, I learned.
They've got this. What are they called? It's called the National Collection Status that they have been granted for their primroses.
Yeah.
And Merrill is launching into new areas. He's found he'll have to talk about it, but he's found a spot in Scotland that does really well with a great variety of poppies. You know, we have our Himalayan poppies. Well, there are many varieties that do well in our climate. So that'll be exciting to hear about.
I had a chance this last summer to spend some time in the botanical garden in Edinburgh. And it is amazing. I found myself wanting to go back there every day that I was in Edinburgh. It was just wonderful.
And I guess there's talk about doing a partnership with them.
Oh, is that right?
The Arboretum and them. Merrill will have to talk about that further. I don't want to say too much because I'm not the expert. But
actually, that Juneau is the primrose capital of the world.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and when we talk about gardens, that's one of the things that I do. I probably have close to 100 varieties of primroses myself in my yard. And it's one of, they're just absolutely incredible plants that...
And then the chance to hear about Charlotte Jewel's operation over in Skagway. I was fascinated. I was there a couple of Julys ago. And I read somewhere, I think it was when I was in Skagway, I read it in some history book I was looking at. But it used to be that people would show up on the tour ships. And what they did while they were in Skagway was they went to the gardens. That was like the premier activity that everyone did. Not Jules Gardens, that didn't exist then, but everyone had gardens, and you took a garden walking tour through Skagway. That was what the 1900s, up until the 1930s, that's what passengers on visiting ships would do.
Ah.
And so Skagway is unique because they have a climatic difference that makes it possible for Charlotte to run that wonderful garden over there. They have a little less rainfall than we do, and unfortunately a lot more wind, but you can shield against that. So,
She'll be discussing some of her propagation techniques and organic weed control techniques. And, she's an interesting woman. I think we've got a real nice lineup. Matter of fact, when I was communicating with Dr. Holloway, she said, I'm excited to come down. I'm going to be speaking with some of the best gardeners in the whole state.
and I'm hoping that all of the gardeners come out for this symposium. The symposium, again, is March 7th and 8th. It begins at 7 o'clock on Friday night in the UAS Egan Library with Horticulture Adventures in Business.
Yes.
And you have four speakers lined up for that, right?
Three
that night. And then there is an all-day session called The Gifts of Gardening on Saturday, March 8th. It is in the big lecture hall at UAS. You have to register online. The address is one of those complex internet addresses, but if you just Google Juneau Garden Symposium, it'll pop right up, I should imagine, right?
I think the best way to have it pop up is go to UAF, as in University of Alaska Fairbanks, Cooperating Community Services, Extension
mm-hmm.
Services, and then go to Juneau and go to events, and you will find it, and that's the easiest to remember.
Okay, good enough. And there's a $40 fee for gifts of gardening, and then from 6 to 7:30 there is a reception scheduled at the Paradise Cafe to wrap things up.
Yes.
Okay, good.
All right.
Thank you so much.
And thank you.
You bet. incidental music is provided by John Coltrane, playing a little Greensleeves there in a nice jazz arrangement. And two of my guests are here to tell us about a program which is coming up here in Juneau. The Unitarian Universalist Fellowship has put together a program about John Coltrane's musical and spiritual journey. Pat McClure and
Rob Cohen.
Rob Cohen are here to tell us about this program. So what's coming up?
On this Sunday morning at 10 a.m., the Juneau Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is doing a service on John Coltrane as a spirit seeker and his music that in that spiritual journey. So we will, I'll get the brass tacks out of the way, we will meet, regretfully, we usually meet at the Temple Sukkot Shalom, but their heating system blew. And so we are going to meet at the Floyd Dryden Middle School Library, which is out on the Loop Road. And we will commence at 10 a.m. And we will not have a CD of Coltrane's music, but instead we have a quintet.
Yes.
Who will be playing John Coltrane's music, of which Rob Cohen is one of the five musicians who will provide the music.
Mm-hmm. And the others are Michael Busey.
Mr. Michael Busey will be playing trombone. Mr. Doug Bridges will be playing the tenor sax. The new guy, young Alexi Painter, will be on bass, and the venerable Clay Good will be playing drums.
Mm-hmm.
I have the pleasure of working with Michael Busey, and we were having lunch one day, and I was telling him about my exploration of Coltrane and having come across the Church of St. John Coltrane in San Francisco, and it piqued my curiosity, and I was doing more research and how fascinating I found it that every Sunday there's a whole congregation that worships using Coltrane's music and his poetry. And Michael Busey said, oh, I got some guys who would be into that.
I know a few guys.
And so I said, go, you have your people talk to my people and we'll see what we can come up with. And we have a service.
So the Church of St. John Coltrane.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I knew that existed.
It does indeed exist.
I had no idea myself until a week or two ago.
It does indeed exist.
Okay. And how large is the congregation at St. John's?
Well, it's the description of it. They have a wonderful webpage and with video and audio. And they said it's the size of somebody's living room, but it has beautiful icons, painted icons, and it's live jazz every Sunday morning with a wide variety of participants.
Spiritual seeker.
Mm-hmm.
So can you give us a little background here? I mean,
well, first I'll give you some background on Unitarian Universalist. Here in Juneau, we have a liberal religious presence here in the capital city. We are lay-led, and I am one of the lay leaders. And part of our seven principles speaks to a search for truth and meaning. And so I, as one of the lay leaders, am always looking for different avenues that people may seek spiritual truth and meaning. And there's a variety of web pages that I look to, Killing the Buddha, BeliefNet, the Religion and Ethics News Weekly, Krista Tibbetts on Being. And that's when I came across this stuff about John Coltrane.
Hmm.
And after he got clean from drugs and alcohol, after Miles Davis told him, you're out of here, and he cleaned up, and Davis took him back, and he played, and then he just took off. And he himself was a spiritual seeker. And although he was raised Christian, both his grandfathers were Protestant ministers, when he was composing and playing music, he explored a variety of religions and spiritualities. And when he came up with A Love Supreme, those liner notes are all about love and communication with the divine, love and communication with God, and gratitude. And
I was just thrilled to pieces that instead of having to play a CD, that Rob and company will step up.
And you might want to reserve that conclusion for after the service. But
would you tell
them,
Rob,
the
music that you'll play?
Yeah, we've chosen three pieces, two of which were specifically composed by John Coltrane in the phase when he was using music as a vehicle for religious transcendence, for not only for himself, but to try to influence his listeners and bring them to a place of transcendence, unity, sense of greater forces and realities than, of which religion is in religious services are commonly used.
What are the pieces?
Pieces are, one is called Spiritual, one is called A Love Supreme, the title track from the album that Pat is mentioning, and then we're going to close with a song he had written for his wife at the time called Naima.
Okay. So these will be performed, and then are you going to be talking about the
In our fellowship, we have, I'm happy to say, families with children, and so I will share a children's book with the kids, which is called Before John Was a Jazz Giant. And then once the children leave for their religious exploration, then I will speak to the congregation about Coltrane's spiritual journey, his musical journey. And in between those happenings, the guys are going to play.
So now this service is at 10 o'clock.
Correct.
And it's not located where you normally meet.
Thank you. Yes.
Instead, you're going to be at?
Floyd Dryden Library.
At the Floyd Dryden Library. Okay, so there's lots of parking, no problem. Okay,
And it's accessible, and right. We're good.
And you're open to anyone who wants to come,
would be thrilled to have new faces at the door to come listen to the music, yes.
Okay, well.
All are welcome.
This is a truly interesting program coming up. This is this Sunday.
This Sunday,
day after
the
23rd. Okay, on the
23rd, correct.
At 10 o'clock in the morning. So this is a special exploration of John Coltrane's musical and spiritual journey put on by the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Juneau and a five-member musical group who will be playing some Coltrane, in particular choosing pieces that reflect his spiritual seeking and attempts to bring some of his listeners into spiritual awareness. Thank you so much for telling us about this great opportunity on Sunday morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll close with a little Coltrane. Okay. We've heard some really interesting opportunities for the weekend here today on Juneau Afternoon. So great things that are coming up. And then on Wednesday, on March 7th and 8th, the Juneau Garden Symposium. So take a look at that. You're in tune with KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. We broadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269AO in London and Schweitzer Creek, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, and in Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org, and support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and thank you very much from listeners like you. Monday, Scott Burton will be hosting. We'll get an update on CBJ activities from City Manager Kim Kiefer. Harborview Elementary School Librarian Julie Leary will be coming on the show. She'll be highlighting the upcoming Read Across America event. And we'll learn about the house across the street from the Governor's Mansion. Guest Mark Choate will be bringing us up on the history of that. And there'll be a preview of Thursday's KRNN Spotlight concert with members of the North Country Cajun Club. So tune in for Juneau Afternoon on Monday with Scott Burton.